We've come in our study in Romans 9 to the paragraph is in verses 19 through 29. And the issue is the whole entire question of whether there is a legitimate question about the righteousness of God when he decrees things that will come to pass, and yet he holds men accountable in their coming to pass. He has an irresistible will, and the question in verse 19 was, why does he still find fault? And so that's where we started this paragraph, and we've worked our way down to verse 22. We looked at that to some degree last time. It's been 3 weeks or so, and so I wanted to go back to that with the issue of God's attitude in the midst of verse 22. In this whole chapter, we've been considering Paul's clarification of the larger plan of God, because at that point in history and in the process of biblical truth, there was such a huge shift in the plan as far as God had revealed. He hadn't ever told anybody that he was going to shift away from Israel for a couple thousand years and build a church and, you know. So because he hadn't explained all that in the prophecies, Paul couldn't really appeal to the Old Testament support that he almost always did in the other doctrinal areas, except for the generalized references to the fact that the Gentiles would ultimately be included, and Paul says that this is at least a part of the fulfillment of that. But in this clarification, Paul started with the issues of the love of God as it's designed to be developed in the hearts of sinful but converted men. And that's the first paragraph where he declares that he has come in his own personal sanctifying process to the point where he would be willing to offer himself as an eternal sacrifice for the sake of his enemies, who are his brethren. And that's really the goal. And all of the issues of the kingdom, it's going to be a kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy. And in order for that to happen, the foundations of correct values and correct beliefs have to be laid. And the issue of correct values is the issue of love. And in the issue of love, you have a particular. The love of God is to be developed in the hearts of sinful men. And in view of all that the scriptures reveal concerning the smaller aspects of this larger plan, this is really the only reasonable place to start, with God developing his own values in our hearts. In fact, the New Covenant promises that ultimately he'll write his law upon our hearts so that our hearts will automatically contain all of the things that are valuable as far as his old plan is concerned. And in this beginning point of pushing the love issue, everywhere in the backdrop of that reality in the scriptures, God's plan is revealed to be an eventual kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy. And there are two points that need to be made at that point. There can be no kingdom that can come into existence without righteousness, peace, and joy. No beneficial kingdom. You can't have a beneficial kingdom without righteousness, peace, and joy. The world has proven that for 6,000 years of history. Beneficial kingdoms have never really survived or even more than just partially existed, because the people in the kingdom didn't value what God valued. They didn't love what he loved. And so there can't be the fulfillment of the larger plan without the development of this righteousness, peace, and joy thing. And for those things to come into existence, love has to be the bottom line. But the plan also is presented throughout the scriptures as an eventual sometime thing. We're told over and over and over that it is our hope, but it isn't here. And what that really means is that there's a specific process involved that is focused on God's bringing his creatures into a full embrace of the chiefest characteristic, which is love. And the chiefest characteristic of this primary attribute is the unhesitating willingness to be an ultimate sacrifice for somebody else's sake if necessary. That's what the love of God tells us. It was necessary in light of sinful man's redemption requirements that God sacrificed himself for our sake. So he did. And then Paul in Romans 9 says he'd be willing to be the ultimate sacrifice for his brethren's sake, with the understanding that it would do some good. And, of course, it wouldn't. And besides that, he couldn't really be that kind of a sacrifice. It takes far more than a human being can give to bring about the basis for forgiveness and restoration. You have to be God to be able to pay a price significant enough that it would meet the need. And then from this goal of developing his love in the hearts of men, in the next paragraph, God reveals through Paul the opposite reality that is a natural follow-up to the love issue. And that's the clarifications of the particulars of the hate of God. In the statement, Jacob I've loved, Esau I've hated. If you're going to focus on love, you're probably going to have to also deal with the issue of hate, since that's the alternative opposite. And how much do we understand love if we don't understand the other issues, and hate's the opposite of other issues? So the better clarification we have on the opposite in this issue of hate, the better we'll understand the love. By the same token, the better we understand love, the better we'll understand the hate. So the second paragraph ends with this, you know, Jacob I loved and Esau hated. And that's, I think, a necessary part also of explaining this larger plan. But the point is that if love exists in a meaningful way, hate must also exist as an automatic corollary. There has to be hatred for anything that would threaten the benefit of the beloved. As long as there are no threats, hate doesn't even have to be in the picture in terms of any real expression of it. It's like the mercy of God. The angels never knew the mercy because they've never seen it, because there was no need to see it, because there'd never been anything that required anybody to be merciful. You just had to be just. Just do what you're supposed to do. Do it with the right motive and do it right, and there won't be any problem. You don't need any long-suffering or patience or mercy and so on. And by the same token, if everybody's operating by love, then you don't need hate to be demonstrated. But if hate is inserted into the mix, and it has been, then you can begin to understand love a little more clearly, because now you're seeing the contrast. And so Paul moves from one paragraph on love to the next one on hate, and then he moves to the declaration on God's part that he has a sovereign right to focus love on those whose sins have made them unworthy and show them mercy. And within this right to show mercy, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, he declares. That's his right. In order for that right to make sense to us, there are a couple of facts involved in that. And the first one is, every human being is initially unworthy. So the option of showing mercy is an automatic, it's already on the table. Ever since the participation of all of Adam's progeny with sin in Genesis 3, mercy's been a divine option, given the gospel, given the fact that justice would be met. So that fact has to be kept in mind. There are lots and lots and lots of people whose rage against God being unfair and all that is rooted in the notion that he owes people something good. And in order to keep that notion from developing, we have to realize that he owes us absolutely nothing good. We're all initially compromised and unworthy. Therefore, we deserve only evil or bad for ourselves, unless God decides to be merciful. So that's part of the issue. I can have mercy, God says, and I will. I'll show mercy to whomever I'll show mercy. And the other issue that is involved in that is that God reserves the right to totally ignore behavior as his basis for his decision to show love, but also to retain that behavior as a basis for his demonstration of judicial hatred. In other words, in order to show mercy, he has to basically ignore the behavior, because the behavior deserves mercilessness. And in order to show mercy, you just kind of have to set the dessert thing aside, which means he won't take any account of the sin. That's what Paul said in Romans 4. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord will not impute sin. He just doesn't impute it. it's there. He knows the person did it, but he doesn't record it in an imputational way because he's intending to show mercy. But on the other hand, all of the judgment of God that is revealed in the New Testament is rooted in an evaluation of their behavior based on their performance. So he ignores their behavior to show mercy, but he retains a focus on their behavior if justice is going to be administered. And the conclusion of this part of Paul's explanation was that God ruled out man's willing and his running. They're not a part of God's exercise of the display of mercy, but man's willing and running are parts of his display of his hatred. And he reacts to that willing and that running with hardening in their case as it suits him. That's the plan. And then Paul moves immediately into man's penchant to blame God for anything and everything that happens to him that he didn't want to happen. It's not fair. Well, Paul's response to that is just point blank. He says in verse 20, "O man, no. Who are you? Who are you? How can you even begin to take the position of a judge of God? You're a creature. You're ignorant. You're puny in terms of infinity in any sense. You are under obligation by creation to be willingly and immediately desirous of serving your Creator however He wants you to. And that precludes sitting yourself over here in the corner as a judge and deciding whether or not you're going to serve Him based on whether you like Him or not, or that you like what you've discovered about Him or not." So that statement that Paul makes is, "Oh man, no, you've gone way too far when you set yourself up as a judge over God." So that brings us to our last study that we had 3 weeks ago, where Paul says that God has been at work in all of these things to bring life to its fullest potential, because that potential exists in man's knowledge of God as He is. And life's most fundamental methodology is revealed by Jesus in John 17:3 as knowing God. "This is life eternal, that they might know Thee." So any areas of pockets of ignorance are going to affect the experience of the life. And if the ignorance turns into arrogance and begins to be accusatory toward God, that's really going to destroy the experience of life. It'll just wipe it out. So, in getting to know God, that's the whole thesis. If God really wanted creatures to come to the essence of His love, He has to give them access to the knowledge that will enable that goal. And that was our argument last time. God was willing, in verse 22, to demonstrate His wrath and make His power known, because without understanding His wrath and His power, men have a skewed view of God, and if they have a skewed view of God, they will end up drawing conclusions and taking actions based on a false perception of God, which is idolatrous, and it will lead to sin. It has to. So, that's why we're in this whole mix where God is determined to say, "I'm going to give life to at least a certain number of these human creatures, and I'm not doing it primarily for their sake. I'm doing it also for the sake of the angelic host," that's Ephesians 3, "but I'm doing it because I've got this kingdom plan in mind." So this evening what we're going to do is look at the statement in verse 22 that focuses on God being willing to demonstrate His wrath and power, and that creates a situation where He endures with much patience vessels of wrath that have been prepared for destruction. In other words, you could argue His irresistible will has led to the presence of depraved, wicked men who are perfectly qualified to be destroyed in judicial destruction, but He doesn't destroy them right away. He endures them. I think that really introduces an idea that most people just completely skip. In the context, the bottom line is the sinner's accusation that if God has an irresistible will, then He must have forced the decision for evil to develop in the original sinner, and that means that sinners are unfairly condemned if righteousness has any meaning at all. So what does Paul say about that? Well, as we've already noticed, he starts at the beginning. He says, "Oh man, no, you can't go there." There are certain things that any thoughtful creature will have to conclude, and one of them is that He is creature, which means He is not infinite in any area of His attributes. And that means that His understanding is going to be marked by huge pockets of ignorance, which means that we can't make accusatory sounds about God, who's omniscient, and have any sense of rightness in it. This is one of the things that the death of Stephen Hawking in the last week or two really drummed into my brain, because here we had a man who's worshipped by the world as a brilliant, brilliant person. Lots of brain power, obviously. But he began to make pontifications about the fact that there's no God and he's an atheist. And he makes these pontifications while he's totally helpless in a wheelchair. And this may sound a little cruel. It's not. It's just a statement of fact. But he didn't have enough sense to be able to figure out how to fix his own body so he could function like a normal human being. And that means he's not nearly as smart as he thinks he is, or thought he was. And being proven to be incapable of the knowledge that would make his life better, he ought to have exercised enough humility to recognize, you know, I don't know nearly as much as I think I know, and my sitting in this chair proves that. And therefore, I have no business telling anybody that there's no God. Because in order to say that, you have to have an infinite knowledge of everything so that you know there's no God. Because any area of ignorance, God might be hiding in that pocket of ignorance. So, the point here is that Paul starts with that. No, man, no, you don't go there. That beginning of man's arrogance started in Genesis 3, but it was engineered by a prior sinner. There was a serpent that came into the garden. And that sinner that came into the garden was of a higher order creature than Adam. Adam really didn't have a whole lot of chance if he had been pitted against the tempter without any input from God, because the person that was doing the tempting was a creature of higher order. The Bible says that even Jesus, when he was made human, was made lower than the angels. And Lucifer is presented in Ezekiel as being one of the highest developed of the order of angelic being. And because of that, he had an innate created ability to outfigure any creature beneath him without any problem at all. He's just that smart. So when he came into the garden, if God hadn't set the stage ahead of time and told Adam, don't eat that fruit. If you do, it will kill you. And in the dying, you will start to die, and it's going to be a bad deal. That statement would have fortified Adam's resistance to temptation by any manner or level of intelligence. All he had to do was say, no, I've been told that that's not a good idea, from a person who's already demonstrated his power and wisdom. And I don't know you from Adam. I don't know you from whoever. I don't even know where you came from. And so I'm not going to put any confidence in anything you say, because I've already heard from the one who's put me in this place of a tremendous benefit and obvious wisdom and power. But he didn't go that way. And because he didn't, Adam's rejection of God's words led directly to sin, and sin led directly to Romans 9 in this accusation of God. This is not fair. God shouldn't be doing things this way. Ever since Adam sinned, he's been blaming somebody else. He blamed Eve. Eve blamed the serpent. It was all of not my fault. And in a very real sense, you have this echo of, well, this must have been some of your will. God, you're the one that has this irresistible will. It's not my fault. It must be your fault. There are echoes of this attitude. So Paul starts there, but then he moves immediately to the necessity of life requiring at least some level of revelation of all of the attributes of God, which include his wrath. If there is any attribute that God keeps hidden from us, to the degree that he keeps it hidden from us, to that degree, our ability to enter into life will be markedly reduced and perhaps even blocked, because the hiding of the attribute will keep us from developing a legitimate theology. Now, as I said, God hasn't hidden anything, but there were certain realities in creation that kept certain things from being manifest, and without them being manifest, they stay hidden. So God had decided that he would bring these things to light. And that's what's going on in verse 22. If God really intends to share his life with creatures, and especially creatures who have been affected by sin, the angels who didn't fall were affected by Lucifer's sin, and the angels that fell with him were directly even more affected by his sin. Human beings have been affected by his sin, and all human beings have been affected by Adam's sin, so that we're in a mix where sin is already in the mix, and God's attitude towards sin's presence in the mix is an attitude of usefulness. He's going to use it, just like Romans 8:28. He uses evil things to bring about good ends because he's smart enough to do that. He can take any evil intended action on a human being's part toward another human being and turn that action into its own defeat and bring benefit to the individual to whom that action was, or against whom that action was taken. That's the wisdom of God at work, and it's part of his promise. But in the statement about wanting to share this life because there has to be this awareness, it says he desired to make his wrath and power known. Well, that means that he's saying, okay, I'm gonna expose the truth about myself to these creatures. I'm going to make them aware that there are all these truths about me in wrath and power, a couple of them. But I want to point out that if there is no life, it's because there can't be any genuine love, because genuine love requires sacrifice, if necessary, to the ultimate degree, and that requirement can't even be known unless there is a situation where that might be possible, that there might be a need for that kind of sacrifice. And God knew, before he ever even started all this, that there was going to come to that level of sacrifice, but he was going to be the first one to pay it, so that it's not wrong for God to require men to be as loving as he is. Since he's willing to pay it, then he can ask us to be willing to pay too, because that's what his love's all about. That's what's going to make the kingdom as glorious as it's going to be, because there won't be anybody in that kingdom who isn't willing to pay an ultimate sacrifice for anybody else in that kingdom. And that willingness by itself will produce a utopia where the glory is just incomprehensible. It's just blow your mind that you could have creatures that committed to one another and to God. So that's part of the thing that's going on. However, one of the things that the accusers of God often ignore is something that Paul stuck in here when he said that God endured with much patience vessels of wrath. And that's the thing that we have to understand. He is describing God's real attitude toward the existence of evildoers. The accusers never explain how God can both force a sinful decision upon an unblameable creature who is simply subject to his irresistible will, and yet, in any sense, call that enduring their presence. You can't say that God had to endure this if God is the one who engineered this. And so you get into this ticklish area where the people who want God to be in absolute control of everything in every respect, so that there's double predestination in the whole nine yards, where God is the author of sin because sin was necessary in his creation for the benefit of life for some, and you know, what's happening here is that Paul is declaring that the existence of vessels of wrath was a despised thing from God's point of view, because that's what "with much patience" means. The word patience is our typical word for long-suffering. And when somebody is compelled to endure with much long-suffering, that's a clear declaration that the person is being subjected to something deeply objectionable to him or her. I don't have to endure with much long-suffering anything that I want to be. I only have to endure what I despise. So if I have to endure it, it indicates automatically that I don't have any, I have not placed any positive value on this. I hate this. And the endurance is the word that says, okay, God's attitude here is a matter of endurance. It's not a matter of, well, now I've got everything in place, we can go ahead and fill this all out and get it all done. It's not that kind of attitude. It's an attitude of despising their existence. Technically, what Paul is saying is, enduring with much long suffering, the alternative to that would have been, as soon as sin was found in Lucifer, Lucifer would have been out of existence. And if it came up in any other angelic being, they'd been gone instantly. God wouldn't have put up with it for a second. If it cropped up in the human race, which may not have even been ever created if the angelic rebellion hadn't occurred, as soon as it cropped up in the human race, they'd have been gone. There would have been no tolerance. That's how you handle stuff that you have to endure without any patience. You just wipe it out. As soon as it pops up, you smack it. Well, Paul is saying that it popped up and God didn't smack it. And especially he is saying that when he couples it to the idea of much long-suffering, because much long-suffering indicates just how deeply the thing is despised. And I really think that people have overlooked this statement because they're making us, in a sense, they're making a picture of God who, in some kind of nefarious way, is declaring himself to be free from the guilt of producing sin and free from unrighteousness, and yet producing sin and making sure unrighteousness is on the scene. That's their picture they want us to create. And Paul's picture is, no, that's a false picture. There is something in the wisdom of God that has to account for enduring with much long suffering. And that's why we use the term tolerating. If God is willing to tolerate something, it's not something he particularly appreciates. He's just putting up with it for a while. And a lot of, especially the monergists, the ones who say there's only one will, and it's God's will, and it's going, everything's going to be done exactly the way he wants it done. Every molecule is going to vibrate exactly like he wants it to, and on and on. There's a lot of feeling in that area of theology that says, yeah, there's no way to get around this. God's the creator, originator of sin. That's just the way it is. Well, Paul would disagree with that. He would say, the fact is God does not value the existence of vessels of wrath. And he is saying that in the face of a mindset of human beings who do not understand. With human beings who do not understand, they would never permit something to happen to them that they didn't want to happen. They would argue that if a person has the power to deny something happening to him, and he doesn't deny it happening to him, then he really wants that to be happening to him. I mean, if you can keep it from happening to you, if you let it happen to you, you must have wanted it to happen to you. That's their argument. But they argue that out of a vacuum of understanding. There's a whole block of ignorance there. And it's a major point of Paul's argument, that God, knowing how detestable the presence of sin is and how destructive its actions, put up with it in its eruption. His terms, Paul's terms, put up with it, endure it, means he didn't force its reality. He allowed it. An allowance is foremost in despising the existence of something while permitting it to come into that existence. That's what allowance is. You permit it. You don't engineer it. And though the creation of persons did inherently raise the specter of sin, because even God can't create God. So if he's going to create anything lesser than God, the possibility of a lesser than God doing something evil is automatic. It's on the table. If you're less than God, there's a real possibility that you'll do something that's not godly. And that's where sin comes into the mix. Well, God had two options. He could have said, I'm not creating anything. we're just going to go along here for all eternity the way we are, and man, I'm not creating anything. There's a potential for a humongous disaster if I do any creating, and so I'm just not going to. He could have said that. But on the other hand, there is this picture in the scriptures that God's desire to share his life with beings that have been created simply because he wanted to share his life with them, then you have to admit that, yeah, the potential's there as soon as he decides he's going to go that way. And the potential was more than just potential because Christ was crucified from the foundation of the world. But the specter, the potential, isn't compulsive. It doesn't force it. Just because God knows something's going to happen doesn't mean he's going to make it happen. And so, allowance inherently means that though there may be other ways of accomplishing something, the thing allowed can, by knowledge and wisdom, be forced into the service of a good result. And God perhaps could have done this a different way, but who's to say? I mean, we can't decide on the basis of God's omniscience and our lack of omniscience what would have been a better path to take. I mean, we can't. The scriptures are clear here in verse 22 that God put up with the eruption of sin. And you, like I said, in any thoughtful human way of thinking, you don't put up with something that you actually engineer and make happen. So, Paul's argument is that he put up with it because he could use it for the good that he wanted. He's got two things he wants to make sure everybody knows. He wants to know, them to know about his wrath so that they can have a valid theology concerning him. And he wants to make his power known. And the power comes in verse 23, where he makes known the riches of his glory to the vessels of mercy. So we'll get to that the next go-around. The point that I want to make is that I understand clearly what people are going to say. Well, you're just saying that God's really not in control. He's just tolerating stuff that happens outside of his control. No. Tolerance is an exercise of control. If you really don't want to tolerate it, you will not let it happen. The fact that you're willing to tolerate it means that you're willing to allow it to happen, but that doesn't mean making it happen. You're just tolerating it. But that is an exercise of control. It's not the kind men have, because men are so self-centered, they wouldn't put up with anything they didn't have to unless they had to. So I think that's part of what Paul is doing in Romans 9:22, is he's declaring an attitude about God where he put up with much long suffering, the presence of vessels of wrath because he knew he could use it for good.